Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program.
We certainly have incorporated a lot of things from Copenhagen into our thinking here in New York, but I feel that now New York also has really started to look at creating a softer coastline.
Today we take to the water, walk the promenades and laze on a few beaches to see how cities are developing some of their most sought-after pieces of waterfront real estate. We look at New York's ever-evolving East River, visit the old site of Hong Kong's International Airport, and join the Sunseekers in a city that you may not realize is home to a number of urban beaches. Oh, and we explore all of that over 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Welcome to today's show. Harbours, rivers and coastlines offer cities a geographical gift like no other. Access to water provides a focal point for recreation to flourish, transportation and logistics to diversify, and residential developments to show themselves off. But urban coastlines also bring difficulties. The need to ensure the safety of citizens and protect against pollution and rising sea levels means that managing a city's relationship with water is just as important as promoting it. Back in February of last year, we looked at a few ways cities were dealing with the problems that urban coastlines can bring, from Oslo's efforts to keep carbon emissions out of its ports to Alexandria's very immediate battle with the rising tides. In today's episode, we wanted to look not just at how cities are dealing with these threats, but also how they're redeveloping, revitalizing, and celebrating the geographical gift that they've been given. So let's start today in New York on a tour of the East River. New York City's Economic Development Corporation projects that 37% of buildings in Lower Manhattan will be at risk from storm surges by 2050. To protect the city from this threat, its shoreline will have to be re-engineered. This work will be environmentally destructive, but some NGOs and private developers are working on sustainable ways to build resilience into New York's shoreline. Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan reports.
I recently went on a boat tour of the East River. We sailed around the tip of Manhattan to a derelict industrial site on a stretch of shoreline in North Williamsburg. Two Trees is a real estate firm who want to develop this site. They're working with the landscape architects James Corner Field Operations to turn it into a public beach and a circular park in the river itself called Rivering. This will adjoin two residential towers designed by Bjarke Ingels Group. After we docked in Lower Manhattan, I spoke with some of the people involved with the project and its partner organizations.
Hi, I'm Lisa Switkin. I'm a principal at James Corner Field Operations, and we're the landscape architecture firm designing the park. So Rivering is really meant to be a forward-thinking new model for urban shorelines. And the idea is that there are two towers which are very compressed in order to provide space for a large upland and in-water park that is quite unique in terms of looking at a soft shoreline for an urban constrained condition to allow for habitat restoration, greater resilience, and water access.
Pete Malinowski, Executive Director of Billion Oyster Project. We're a nonprofit dedicated to restoring oyster reefs to New York Harbor through public education initiatives. So it's all about restoring the ecology of the harbor and using that effort as a way to engage all New Yorkers in and build awareness and affinity for the natural resource around us.
And how do your organizations work together, particularly in relation to this project?
Well, I think that this is a really great partnership because we're both trying to make a very immediate connection to the water. And in this type of partnership, you know, while we're designing the park and getting, you know, vital insights from Billion Oyster Project in terms of what would benefit their work, we're also promoting nature and estuary education, and, you know, really sort of creating the foundation for work that Pete would do in the future.
Peter, I was struck by your description, excuse me, of what New York would have looked like, well, a very long time ago. I've forgotten the specific amount of time. Could you rehearse that for me?
Well, 500 years ago? Yeah, I mean, we don't think about all these port cities as being important biological engines, but they all are. So 22 of the largest 30 cities in the world are built on estuaries that used to have thriving oyster populations. And in all of those cities, we've destroyed the oyster population. And so New York Harbor, when Europeans first arrived, they said, we'll never need to go to Sweden again for stockfish. There's more fish here than we could ever possibly eat. And, you know, in a matter of about 100 years, that had been completely removed for food by humans. So I think that that's a really familiar story. And, you know, the type of abundance that of animal abundance that used to exist here in New York Harbor doesn't exist anywhere on Earth anymore because it's been destroyed by humans.
Why the focus on oysters?
Well, I think the forest analogy is helpful. So if you imagine New York Harbor used to be a forest filled with oak trees, you know, you wouldn't ask the same question about why are we planting oak trees. That's what used to be here. It's a dominant habitat type, and it's the same with the oysters. Oysters provide the three-dimensional habitat, and they were completely dominant in the harbor. It was a landscape made up of oyster reefs. So using any other animal doesn't replace what used to be here.
And isn't it true that oysters are also a kind of indicator species that help you actually really understand water quality in the harbor, et cetera?
Yeah, you can see, you know, in places like Newtown Creek that are still very polluted, you can, you know, there's wild oysters near the mouth of the creek, and then you can see them sort of disappear as you go further in, and there's, you know, lower dissolved oxygen and other pollution in the creek.
Nice sort of visual cue almost, where you can actually understand the health of the estuary by understanding what is living and you know, where there are oysters and where there are not oysters.
And maybe you can explain the, I suppose, construction philosophy behind the projects as it relates to, yeah, nature and habitat.
Sure. I mean, this is a really unique opportunity. I think when you look up and down the estuary, you know, the status quo and the primary condition is really a hardened edge, a bulkhead. And after Sandy, I think the gut reaction was just to not only continue that, but actually further divorce the relationship between people and water and raise the bulkhead up. So here we're actually breaking that down and trying to create a gradient landscape and soft shoreline that needs more space. And so, you know, that actually has to be balanced with the building footprint, with the DEC and other things, but that this kind of creates this really longer kind of gradient or line that also adds further protection and risk reduction for resilience long-term.
And you want to get people back in the water on a recreational level as well. I would hesitate to do so. How willing do you think people are to get in there, and what can be done to make them more willing?
So that's a great point. I mean, I think that this is something that is a shift in mindset. There's sort of physical aspects, and then there's psychological aspects. And, you know, first is creating a safe environment. And so the breakwaters actually reduce wave energy by 70%, so you have calmer waters, which allow for that first kind of safe environment to do so. Starting with boats, starting with things that, you know, maybe are on a beach where you're doing a kind of tidal exploration or near the wetlands. And then eventually, as water quality continues to improve in the harbor, you know, the hope is that 10, 15 years from now, this could be one of the first places where you could swim in the river because it is that kind of safe, calmer waters.
I'm interested in talking to both of you about the, I suppose, political environment of trying to do environmentally conscious and productive work within New York. Pete, maybe starting with you, you know, what kind of political obstacles do you have to navigate in order to get the work done that you want to get done?
I could literally talk for an entire day about that question. The system isn't set up. There's a million rules to keep bad things out of the water. There's no rules to help put good things in the water. The New Yorkers and Americans are terrified of liability. And, you know, despite the fact that 1.1 million public school students spend their day, you know, go to school standing on subway platforms and crossing big, busy avenues, which are far more dangerous than standing at the water's edge, it does not compute. And one of the reasons it's so hard to touch water in New York City is because there are fences and bulkheads preventing people from going in the water because of the, you know, fear of someone getting hurt or something like that. But we've, you know, through our work with New York Harbor School, You know, we've managed to get permission to put teenagers underwater in scuba gear to grow and restore oysters throughout the harbor. And the biggest thing we deal with, our biggest barrier to our work, are the fears about health and safety and liability. So we have full-time staff members who spend all their time getting permission to put oysters in the water, getting permission to put students in the water. So it's a big part of what we do.
And what are your main political concerns?
Well, I think it's the same with public space. Those same concerns show up in terms of ensuring, primarily the health, safety, and welfare of people. But at the same time, just as Pete sort of said, I mean, there's so much regulation to try to prohibit the bad. But those things can also sometimes prohibit the good. And so we are kind of working very closely with the regulatory agencies in order to put things in place that continue to protect from the bad and ensure that, habitat, that resilience infrastructure, that these things which are, benefiting can actually be permitted. And not a lot of developers have the patience or, want to commit to the funding that requires. But we're lucky with River Ring that there is that larger ethos and philosophy that this is overall a public benefit and worth doing. And so we hope that will inspire others to do the same.
So my name is Kai Bergman, partner at Bjarke Ingels Group, architectural office based here in New York.
One of the things that I found most interesting on the tour in terms of the observations you made is just comparing the experience that you've had working in European cities, Copenhagen in particular, versus working in New York. What are the biggest differences, to your mind, between those two environments?
Of course, scale. Copenhagen is a port city, as is New York. New York just has, hundreds of miles of coastline between the five boroughs. But what they do share is a kind of industrial past, and moving that industrial past into some form of a future that kind of allows for people to live along the waterfront, to create recreational areas that you can enjoy, and also new forms of working along the waterfront. So I think that there are a lot of lessons that can be learned, and we certainly have incorporated a lot of things from Copenhagen into our thinking here in New York. But I feel that now New York also has really started to look at, creating a softer coastline. And with a project like River Ring, we actually have a project that can also influence European cities.
Do you think that there's a greater degree of, congruity or mutual influence when it comes to global thinking around these kinds of projects now than maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years ago?
There's a lot of sharing. And I think that there are cities looking for best practices. And I don't think that there's any one kind of solution to resiliency issues and water issues. So it's actually good to get a broad base of ideas. And they can be actually little steps. And then you can sort of place them together into creating sort of larger leaps. What we have here is a kind of more ecological proposal than many of the sort of hard engineering solutions. And I think that that's also a model for private development globally to look at River Ring as a future.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Henry Reese Sheridan.
Thanks, Henry. And you can hear more about the River Ring project at riverring.nyc. Next up, we're off to Hong Kong, to the Kai Tak Cruise Terminal. Kai Tak began its life as an airfield and was home to Hong Kong's international airport from 1925 to 1998. The inner city runway became infamous for its particularly difficult approach, but by the end of its life, the airport was well exceeding its designed capacity, and that thrilling approach was starting to restrict new building heights and placements in the city. Since its closure, this prime piece of waterside real estate has seen a number of plans for redevelopment. Along with the new cruise terminal, which opened in 2013, Plans for parks, entertainment, and retail spaces, and even a sports park have all been drawn up, many of which have already begun to see their way to completion. To give us an update on what stage the developments are now at, well, we sent our Hong Kong bureau chief, James Chambers, for a walk in Kai Tak Runway Park. Let's listen in.
It's a blustery Monday morning in Hong Kong, and I'm standing on the rooftop of the Kai Tak cruise terminal in Kowloon Bay, looking out across Victoria Harbour. The Chinese and Hong Kong flags can be heard fluttering overhead, interrupted on occasion by the odd helicopter ferrying local business tycoons across the water. From this vantage point, it's easy to imagine being on the bow of a large ship, except on this berth, there's certainly no one claiming to be king of the world. Instead, I watch three elderly Chinese ladies hide from the sun under umbrellas, while a security guard walks lazily around. He pauses for a moment to help the trio take a photograph. Selfies are one activity that does seem to be allowed on this deck. Killjoy signs posted around the building ban smoking, skateboarding, kite flying, ball games, pets, and model aircraft. They may just as well ban people. Kai Tak Cruise Terminal is an eerily quiet spot in an otherwise crowded city. Pre-wedding photography is another reason for visiting this picturesque location, though that certainly wasn't the project's original selling point. Built on the runway of Hong Kong's iconic former airport, Norman Foster's futuristic design for Kai Tak Cruise Terminal was meant to bring hundreds of thousands of ocean-going passengers to this former airstrip and revive the surrounding East Kowloon area. The first passenger ship docked in June 2013, to great fanfare and at great expense. Kai Tak was meant to process some 3,000 tourists every hour, but today, after 8 choppy years, it has all the hallmarks of a ghost ship. Dusty escalators are shut down to save energy, and the duty-free area downstairs is completely sealed off. The shelves of the Emporio Armani concession have been stripped bare, and the same goes for Michael Kors, Swarovski, and Sunglass Hut. The only vehicles in the huge car park appear to belong to Tesla drivers, making good use of all the electric charging stations. While it is true that right now, other parts of the city are looking just as abandoned and unloved, this is one empty space in Hong Kong that can't be blamed on the pandemic or the protests. Cruise liners haven't been coming to Kai Tak for years, and its failure to launch as a transport hub ultimately comes down to connectivity. Kai Tak is tricky to get to, and most operators prefer to dock at a more centrally located terminal, where tourists can disembark in the heart of downtown Tsim Sha Tsui. Newspaper writers spotted these gaping holes at the very beginning, and even the subsequent explosion of tourism in mainland China couldn't keep Kai Tak afloat. But the journey is far from over. The flagship cruise terminal may one day have to be cut loose and perhaps turned into another conference centre. However, the rest of the government's ambitious master plan to turn the old airport into a second central business district alongside Kowloon Bay and Kwun Tong is beginning to take shape. Kai Tak MTR station opened last year, connecting the area to Hong Kong's extensive subway network. By the middle of the decade, this vital public transport link will be bringing football fans and concert-goers to a new 50,000-seater sports stadium that is being built at the north end of the old airport, surrounded by a swathe of shopping malls and residential developments that will one day house around 90,000 people. A glimpse of Kai Tak's future can be seen by walking along the new Kai Tak Sky Garden, which opened earlier this year. The raised pedestrian walkway runs up the middle of the old runway, ending where the cruise terminal begins. At the start of the business week, a steady trickle of joggers run alongside the herb gardens, fountains, and construction workers who sit on shaded benches, wolfing down rice and grabbing a mid-morning snooze. There is also the odd estate agent keeping an eye out for prospective buyers. The Sky Garden currently doubles as a viewing platform for the 9 or 10 waterfront residential developments that are in various stages of construction, from large holes in the ground to a 20-story tower covered by bamboo scaffolding and green netting. Everywhere you look, cranes, diggers, pile drivers, and dumper trucks are busy laying foundations and moving earth for a who's who of Hong Kong and mainland Chinese property developers. The first homes will be ready in 2023. That's when people will really start to come to the area in large numbers, even if most of these arrivals will be long-staying Hong Kong residents rather than international tourists. It's been 23 years since the last aeroplane departed from the old airport, and finally, the new-look Kai Tak is getting ready to take off. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm James Chambers.
We finished today in Toronto. As beach spots go, Canada's largest city might not be the first place that springs to mind, but as our bureau chief in the city, Thomas Lewis, explains, Toronto boasts a wealth of sandy strips along its shores with Lake Ontario, which are among the city's most treasured public spaces. Thomas headed along to one of his favourite lakeside spots to bring us this report.
One of my favourite spots along Toronto's shoreline is an unassuming, well-maintained ornamental rock garden named Marilyn Bell Park. The park commemorates the place where one of the most storied feats in Toronto's history reached its climax and is named after the woman who undertook it on the night of September the 8th in 1954.
Within 24 hours, a petite 16-year-old high school student from New Toronto became famous and richer by some $60,000 for becoming the first person to swim across cold and tricky Lake Ontario. The 5'1" swimmer who startled experienced mariners by finishing the swim, grants an exclusive interview to CBC Television News.
Marilyn Bell was just 16 years old when she swam across Lake Ontario, a feat which made her an overnight national sporting heroine.
She was forced to swim much further than the planned 51.5-kilometer route due to poor water and weather conditions. With Coach Ryder's guidance and steely determination, she reached the Toronto shoreline approximately 21 hours after her start. Her feat made headlines across the nation. Marilyn Bell became an instant celebrity.
The record-breaking swim was big news in Toronto at the time. Hourly updates on her progress were broadcast on the city's radio stations right throughout the night. And by the time she made land at just after 8 p.m. the following day, near the spot where Marilyn Bell Park now sits, 100,000 people had gathered to welcome her out of the water.
Marilyn, the one thing I'm interested in knowing, and I suppose a lot of people are, what gave you the greatest encouragement? I mean, at some times you thought perhaps, well, now I just can't go on. What was it that gave you the encouragement to cross Lake Ontario?
Well, I think it was the idea that I knew everyone was pulling for me at home, like all my friends and even people I didn't know. And then also Gus, he was pulling, I knew he was pulling for me all the way. And then the Lakeshore Swimming Club that I belong to, the kids out there, you know, they're all wishing me the best. And I don't know, when you have people pulling for you like that, you don't want to stop.
No, I don't suppose so.
Nearly 70 years after Marilyn Bell's feat, it's spaces like the park that bears her name that speak to Toronto's long relationship with the body of water it sits alongside. I think it's fair to argue that despite several planning decisions that were made in the 20th century that had the effect of separating the city from its shoreline, Toronto's sense of itself has long been twined to its waterside setting. Toronto's name is believed to derive from an indigenous word, which, loosely translated, refers to trees standing in water. And nowhere is that relationship clearer, during the summer months at least, than via the scenes on Toronto's 11 publicly maintained beaches that are open from June to September each year. Many of them, like the location of Marilyn Bell Park, have played their own roles in various chapters of Toronto's history over the years. In the city's East End, for example, there's a neighbourhood named after them, the Beaches, whose long turn-of-the-century wooden boardwalk is evocative of the neighbourhood's affluent heyday. As is Sunnyside Beach in the city's West End, with its grand neoclassical swimming pavilion, which is a short walk away from Marilyn Bell Park. Then there's Hanlon's Point on the Toronto Islands, which is arguably the most boisterous of Toronto's sandy stretches, which is accessible by ferry or by water taxi. It's here that the first iteration of Toronto's Pride Parade took place in 1971. And in the next year or two, there'll be a new addition to Toronto's beach landscape. In January this year, the Montreal-based landscape design studio Claude Cormier and Associates won a contest to design a new park and beach on the site of a disused dock in Toronto's East End. There have been attempts in recent years to bring the beaches to life during the winter too. The Winter Stations Design Competition, which was launched back in 2015, invites designers from across Canada and the rest of the world to temporarily transform several lifeguard stations dotted along the sand in Toronto's East End into warming huts during the winter months. Well, summer beach season is well underway here. The water's still a little chilly to venture into at the moment, but that hasn't kept people away from the beaches themselves, after a long year of some of the longest city lockdown measures anywhere in the world. And the good news is that the beaches, like the city itself, are tentatively coming back to life once again. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
That's Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis, and a big thank you to him. Just listening to the reports today, it's clear that we're going through a really exciting moment in our cities. Look, the pandemic has forced us all to look at where we live afresh and begin to ask some really simple but vital questions too. Do we have enough places for people to play and relax in? Are we making the most of our city's natural assets? And what can we do better? We've all known for a long time that salvation to these problems often laps at our very feet in the form of the rivers that glide through our cities and the urban coastlines that too often have been ignored. Because in the past, it was easy for planners to run roads or train lines along the banks of our rivers, or allow high-rise developments to colonise waterfronts. And in doing so, this cut them off from the rest of the city, making them no longer places where people could go at the weekend to wade in water to play with their kids. This is clearly a time when many of these old planning wrongs can be undone, and we can also put in place a series of new rules and regulations to ensure that we understand the value of water, we understand the need to be connected to our coastlines. And along riverbanks and along shorelines, across Europe, across America, around the world, the tide is turning. You're seeing people use them in more interesting ways. Pop-up beaches in the summer, places to set up bars and cafes on beaches too, but also an understanding of their vital role in protecting us from storm damage, from being connections to nature at a time when we know that our cities often make us feel a little bit sad and weaker if we don't have this fundamental link to nature every day. So I guess the message of the show this week is, go on, get out there and make a splash in your city too. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show, along with some assistance from Jack Dewars. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's America with Riverside.
Living on the riverside, taking it all in my stride. Living on the riverside, I'm taking life like a big long ride. Stay on your side and I'll stay on mine. You take what you want and I'll take the sunshine.